Blog Talk Radio.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish this
and
Constitution,
so, my fellow Americans,
the United States of America.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for
this nation. Under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
So sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
From the very heart of the Constitutional Republic of the United States of America, from the soul of the Bellwether State, Missouri Grassroots Radio is live.
We are live. This is Friday night. It is one of our favorite nights at Missouri Grassroots Radio. It's the roundtable. Lisa and I are here. We don't know who else might drop in from the usual crowd, but we'll get started with you. Lisa, how are you?
I'm doing just great tonight, Dave. How are you?
I'm great. How was your day?
It was very busy, but it's good.
Good. Yeah, mine was busy too, and incredibly stressful. My wife started the ball rolling too long ago to stop it at this point in time with all the advertising and things for our annual yard sale. So here I am today. Here I am today, sitting out there in the yard in 102 degree weather, it's been a day.
The sale starts here tomorrow.
Started today. Today and tomorrow, yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, there I was out there today. Do you suppose that there is anything at all now that the federal government can't force us to do?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
So
I mean,
the IRS man to come knocking at your door to get the taxes on what you sell tomorrow at your yard sale.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's just not a matter of collecting taxes. I mean, they've been overtaxing us for years, but finally now they are in a position where they can force us to do anything, to participate in any activity, and it just is amazingly sad to me.
I was pretty much knocked off my feet yesterday. I was very surprised. I didn't expect it. I was very sure that we were going to get the original mandate, and they were going to give us the rest to deal with in a big mess. And total opposite. I just didn't expect it coming.
Well, Vaughn's arrived. Lisa and I were just talking about. Do you suppose there is anything at all now that the federal government can't force us to do or participate in?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I would not expect the Supreme Court to pinch hit for me in something as important as this. They are notoriously unpredictable because they have no one to whom they should answer, and I'm not surprised at all.
Oh, I'm not surprised. I mean, the question, though, is, given this ruling and from this point forward, is there anything left that the government can't force us to do or any activity that the government can't now force us to participate in?
Yeah. I think if we look at it that way, that there's nothing else we can't be forced to do, then we overlook the power of grassroots movements like ours and like others to kick it back to where it rightfully belongs, which is the legislature, to undo it. They can undo it with a line item. They can undo it with a repeal. I mean, they undid prohibition.
Well, sure,
it can be undone.
Absolutely. I mean, this can be undone, but I mean,
it doesn't, just because the Supreme Court says that the government can encroach in unbelievable, unprecedented ways doesn't mean that Congress or the next president will allow it to happen. And if this law disappears, then the whole ruling has no meaning.
Well, that I mean, I agree with you that yes, we can undo this law. But my point is that having set this precedent in a body where precedent evidently seems to overrule everything, you know, two administrations and three Congresses down the road, if they decide they want to do something to us, they're going to be able to.
Yes and no. Historically, the Supreme Court has been known for setting precedent and has historically reversed itself on precedent from time to time. It's not unusual for them to set a precedent which becomes outdated. I mean, Dred Scott was a precedent. But they do this all the time. And just because they do it doesn't mean that this is the way that the law is going to go for the end of all time. So I would not expect this to have the effect that most people think of when they think of the Supreme Court doing something. I think that in the end, historically speaking, if Obamacare fails miserably on all accounts, as we all expect it will, and as it inevitably will because there's just no money for it, if it does, this too will pass. Precedents set by the Supreme Court passed decades, centuries. They come and they go.
Lisa, you had something there.
I wish I had Vaughn's optimism. I think, of course, I agree with her. I believe she's technically right. Obviously, she knows what she's talking about. It's the faith to get it done that I think is the question that's up in the air in everybody's mind. You know, will the Congress take care of it? Will the next president take care of it? I don't know. I think that's what we're all here fighting for. You know, we've traditionally, and in recent history, have seen that we've got leadership that doesn't generally take care of it. Once it's in for good. And I think Vaughn is right, though. You know, I mean, we're here in the this grassroots movement has done amazing things in 3 years, and I'm hoping that we can continue to do so. But it's a wild card. You just don't know, and it's a little scary.
Well, I think this decision has given the grassroots movement a great deal of strength that it didn't have 24 hours ago. It has polarized this country like none other.
Oh, I believe so, and that was the next thing I was going to ask. How badly does this, in fact, hurt Barack Obama? I mean, the 71% of the people who are opposed to this in Missouri is really almost a mirror of polls nationwide. I mean, almost three-fourths of the people, Democrat and Republican alike, are against this thing and against the individual mandate, against some part of this thing. And so, I mean, has he lost a lot of base over this?
I think he has, but at the same time, I think that the whole point of it is that he draw in the people who previously would not have had any reason to go to the polls and reelect them. So with this part, and with the part that the Supreme Court held was unconstitutional, with the whole Medicaid issue, you're going to see a lot of states facing a tough decision of whether to poll for Barack Obama, because now the Supreme Court has set up a situation where they have to be bribed with Medicaid money in order to go along with Obamacare.
Lisa?
I'm not quite sure what to add to that, yeah?
This hurt him or help him?
You know, I think he got a great shot in the arm yesterday. I think this energized his base quite a bit. But, you know, at the same time, it's a crapshoot. It's kind of hard to say. You know, Mitt Romney raised $4.6 million since yesterday morning. So I think, you know, on the one hand, yeah, I think the sleeping giant has been stirred. I hope the sleeping giant has been stirred. Mm-hmm. You know, I was kind of taking a lot of pleasure in the fact that Barack Obama was having a bad few weeks there. You know, this kind of turned it all around for him. I'm not quite sure where that leaves him.
Temporarily,
you know,
Lisa.
I'm sorry?
Temporarily turned it all around.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. I really hope you're right. You know, I think it was a really good shot in the arm for him yesterday, but, you know, I'm kind of waiting to see the groundswell of anger, and maybe $4.6 million is the groundswell of anger. Maybe that's what it is.
Okay, let's talk about something else for just a second. Anybody see Ben Swan today?
No.
So tip of the hat for this one to Ben Swan. The health care bill, I don't know if you remember how it all evolved, but they couldn't get it through the House. They couldn't even get it to a vote in the House, the House bill. So the Senate passed a bill, which they shot over to the House. Now, of course, to get a bill in the House, to get a bill out of debate and onto the floor for a vote takes a two-thirds, you know, for cloture. That is, yes. Let's stop debating this and go vote on it. Well, they couldn't get the two-thirds. They thought they could get half. So the Senate passed a bill easily, of course, because they were controlled by the both were actually controlled, but the Senate was overwhelmingly controlled by the Democrats. So the Senate passed a bill, thank you, Claire McCaskill, and they sent it over to the House of Representatives where it wasn't going to pass. So, you know, if you remember all the little hocus pocus that went on, they did a reconciliation where they actually got the thing passed without ever having to vote on it. But that's neither here nor there to what I'm trying to get to. So then they sell this bill to the Democrats who are wavering by saying that because the reason some Democrats were wavering is because this is a massive tax increase. And a lot of Democrats had come to town saying no tax increases for the middle class, including the president. So they sold
this. So we
can
thank John Roberts for describing it as exactly what it is.
Well, that's where we're going, yeah. We can thank John Roberts. I don't thank John Roberts for much of anything this week, but they then went to the Supreme Court and argued that it was, in fact, a tax because they knew they would not get an individual mandate through the Supreme Court at all if you were penalized. That is, if you get a fine for not doing it, then you're not going to be able to get this through the Supreme Court. But by defining it broadly as a tax, they got it through the Supreme Court.
I want to disagree with you a little bit because I don't believe that Attorney Verrilli, so the Solicitor General, even made that argument. I don't think he even considered making that argument. I think that what happened in reading the decision was that John Roberts pointed out quite correctly that he didn't make the argument that this was a tax. Of course, he avoided it like the plague. But the justice, John Roberts, Justice Roberts, made that argument for him, which is a little bit unusual sometimes because usually when you're appealing something, you get struck down, you get sent home, you get your spanking when they tell you as a final kiss-off that you could have maybe argued X, Y, and Z and you didn't, and since you didn't, goodbye.
Okay.
So will you talk to that a little bit, Vaughn, because that's something that really kind of just threw me for a loop. Okay, so they go in and they argue it on one level, and then the justice rewrites their argument for him and gives them a birthday present. I don't know.
Yeah,
is that
not
standard?
Normal.
No,
it's not normal. You're supposed to make your own argument. You're supposed to come up with your own arguments. It's almost impossible for the average case to make it past the appellate court level, much less the Supreme Court level. And justices in every level in the appeals process traditionally decide the narrow issue that you place before them.
Now, okay. Now here's where Swan goes with this thing. Okay, and you know I like this. I will bet that within the next 3 weeks you see 20 or 25 new cases filed in federal court that will of course make their way to the appellate courts. And I think before the Supreme Court comes back the first Monday of October, that they have a case sitting there waiting for them on this very law again, because it is now established, am I wrong, that this penalty is a tax?
Yes.
Where must tax bills start?
Congress.
Where in Congress?
In the House, of course.
And where did we just say this bill started?
This, of course, originated right out of the hands, right out of John Roberts' hot little hands.
No. This case originated in the Senate. In the Senate.
Right.
It was a Senate bill that went to the House. If it's a bill that raises revenue through tax, it must start in the House of Representatives.
I don't necessarily think that argument's going to be a winning argument, though. I think the Congress has the power to levy taxes. I don't think that
The Constitution is pretty clear that any tax that raises revenue has to start in the people's house.
Well, I don't know that that's going to be able to get us over the hump. It's such a technical distinction. I don't know. I'm not a constitutional scholar, much like Barack Obama, so I'm no expert in con law, although we all took the classes.
What was most disappointing about this thing to you, Lisa? The one thing about it that was most disappointing.
You know, I can't really speak on a technical level. I mean, I just don't have the expertise, but, you know, I felt so betrayed by the process and that the fact that the Constitution was so clearly bastardized to bring this around. You know, the action of Justice Roberts rewriting the decision, you know, that was never argued before him in the first place to bring a desired outcome. I think that was the most, you know, our Constitution was just torched yesterday.
And it's not even as disappointing that he rewrote it to bring about a desired income. It is disappointing that Justice Roberts has a desired outcome to start with.
Well, I think
action yesterday, just purely speaking from an emotional level, I mean, his actions were just outrageous.
Yes.
And disappointing and just took my faith. I mean, if I had any faith in the process left, it just took it all away.
Vaughn?
Well, I think that the most disappointing part of this is the hypocrisy of it all. And by that, I mean, this law was intended to cover, 20 to 30 million people who aren't covered by health insurance. And yet, people who work for McDonald's and other large corporations who have gotten their waivers, the very people this law was meant to cover and provide for, these folks are not going to get the health insurance coverage because their companies, who would normally be required to chip in, have gotten waivers.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree.
The most disappointing thing to me was Roberts himself. My faith in the court was slowly but surely being restored. You know, we've had some great decisions this term. The decision of the church that wanted to be able to hire and or fire a teacher based on some religion. There have been the decision against the service members union last week. And then this week, I mean, just a dreadful 1-2. The Arizona thing from Roberts, it is, and then this from Roberts. It just.
If I could offer another perspective on this, I am disappointed that the Chief Justice isn't named Samuel Alito, but I will say this: if you think back. This isn't the first time that the Supreme Court has basically pulled law out of its rear end, made it up of fairy dust and acorns. I mean, when you look at Roe versus Wade, there was no precedent for Roe versus Wade. There's no case law. There's no history. There are no scientific journals. There was nothing. They literally had to make it up as they went along. And I think they were down to reading Cosmo or whatever the equivalent was and Women's Home Journal or whatever to get some perspective on that particular law, but it was literally an invented thing. And again, I think that for all the impact that this may have right now, this whole far-reaching notion that the government has no checks and balances anymore, Supreme Court justices grow old and retire and die all the time. I think that, as it has always been, that a new makeup of the court will turn it around. Courts will birth themselves. all the time.
Well, unless
they go in one direction and then they dial it down.
You know, and this is probably, I mean, even more than the economy, which I think is teetering on the brink of total destruction. And if we get another 4 years of Barack Obama, I think is going to be totally destroyed. But even more than that, because I guess you could argue that we could pull that out. We are going to be set back for another 50 or 60 years in the Supreme Court if Barack Obama gets reelected. I mean, you can put your finger right now on three justices who've got to go in the next 4 or 5 years. I mean, they are either going to die or get so old they can't talk anymore.
Are you talking Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Kagan?
Yes.
Isn't that odd that there are the three women on the court?
It is odd that they're the three women, and it is odd that they're the three that walk with their left ear almost on the ground.
Well, you know, I guess Greece is sitting over there. The Greek government is looking at this and watching us lurching towards insolvency and enjoying a little moment of ha-ha. So I think that we're going to be heading that way. I feel bad for the small businesses. There are a lot of businesses out there who cannot afford in this economy to purchase health insurance for their employees, and this is really going to put a crimp, not even in profits, but just in the ability to stay open, to keep the doors open. This is going to hurt, and of course, you know, if you're not McDonald's and you don't have powerful friends who can get you your waiver, you're going to be hurting. But here's what I thought this morning. You know, the federal government is now going to have to bribe individual states who refuse to adopt Obamacare by saying, we're not going to increase your Medicaid money. What happens if states, and I think there are 26 of them, what happens if states say, fine, keep your Medicaid increase. We'll be fine without it. What's going to happen if insurance in the state such as Missouri, which, you know, voted overwhelmingly to reject Obamacare, if we say we're not taking any more Medicaid money and you're not going to be able to buy us off, what happens when insurance here gets prohibitively expensive and people know that they can go to another Obamacare-friendly state? Are we going to now lose all the people who we'd otherwise have to support, leaving us with folks who can't afford to pay for themselves and take care of themselves and thereby strengthen Missouri's economy? What do you think about that?
I think that's a good argument, and it's an argument that's been made on several fronts, not just this front, and it's a great argument. I mean, states like Arizona say, you know, if we crack down on illegals, well, you know, hello, California, and we'll just gladly pile them all on you.
Yeah, I mean, and in California, I think two or three cities have already decided to file bankruptcy. I think one was rejected by the bankruptcy court. They're hurting in California to the point that the public is voting in some cities to dial down union pensions and wages.
Yes. But I think you're right. I mean, I think that's exactly what will happen, you know, and I mean, I have friends and family even who were talking that if this thing got thrown out by the Supreme Court, they were going to pack up and go to another country.
Well, I can certainly understand, but I wouldn't do it. I mean, I was born and raised here. I'd want to stay here and fight. I never did understand why illegal immigrants came pouring over the border from Mexico searching for a better way of life as opposed to staying in Mexico and fighting for it. But to each his own.
Yeah,
I wouldn't want to leave because I have a stake in staying.
Well, and
I think that is I think, you know, 80%, you get that 80-20 thing, 80% of, or 20% of the people do, you know, the work for 80% of the, I can't remember the exact quote, but I think that's what you got. I think it's human nature. You know, if there's an easy way out, I think the largest part of the bell curve is going to look for the easy way out. It's easier to cross the border than it is to stay and fight.
There you go. Go ahead.
I think that's, and you look at the Patriot movement, you know, you've got, while it's growing, it should be a lot bigger than it is. You know, you've got a few people who really do understand. You've got a smaller percentage of the country who really does understand what's going on. And you got some people that are kind of watching it. They may agree, but they're just kind of following along. you know.
Well, wait until it hits their pocketbook.
Yeah, and it's not hurting them enough.
Yeah, wait until they take a direct hit. Yeah. Wait until they try to go for a job that suddenly disappears because the employer doesn't want to get above 50 employees. Wait until people start hiring, for instance, spouses whose other halves already have dependent insurance coverage so that they don't have to bring on someone they have to pay for.
Right.
You're going to start seeing this. And on the one hand, it might be great for veterans and their families because I have no problem hiring a veteran. Veterans have TRICARE and CHAMP VA.
We're not going to have TRICARE anymore.
They're working on administratively ruling TRICARE into the ground to
force soldiers
to join Obamacare.
That's right. Yeah, we've already been told that we're going to fall under Obamacare.
You're going to see some strong resistance to that.
Oh, you will. You will. Yeah.
That is one of those political hot chestnuts that will die quietly, I think.
That'd be fine with me if people had a preference to hiring vets again, because I'll be able to get a job then. Listen, we're at 347-677-1835. That's 347-677-1835. We're going to take your calls on this topic, or we may even get into one or two other topics. There's plenty more we can talk about here. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and take your calls, and we're going to move on from here. This is Missouri Grassroots Radio. You're on the Friday Night Roundtable with Lisa, Vaughn, and Dave.
Okay, Missouri Patriots, I don't have to remind you that our ancestors fought and died for our right to exercise our voices and shape government in the interests of the people. And yet, in most elections, less than 20% of the population bothers to vote. Gas prices are outrageous, the economy is a disaster, and we are being regulated to death. Bad government and weak leadership are destroying the American way of life on a national and state level, and it's time to send a message to Washington, D.C. and Jefferson City and tell them we have had enough. If you're not registered to vote, the deadline to be eligible to vote in the August primary is July 11th and October 10th for the general election in November. The Patriot Revolution begins in 2012, and it happens at the polls. Vote in the August primary and the November general election, and bring a friend. The Constitutional... I've got a feeling that the
tide is turning. Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
Is life so sweet or peace so precious that it is worth the chains of slavery? We're about there, folks. We're about there. Okay. This is Missouri Grassroots Radio. We're here every night on Monday nights and Thursday nights. We do the Hour of Truth. This Monday night, we're going to be talking extensively with Bill Randles, candidate for governor, on Tuesday night. What do we do on Tuesdays? Who's got something for Tuesday night?
I have.
Oh, okay. Vaughn, what do you got going?
Show me common sense. We're talking about fundraisers, and I call it "Why Are You Pimping My Kid?" because I think that parents have reached critical mass with all of the fundraisers. You've got kids and families competing with each other, and we're trying to explore why we even need to do that, and why are our kids so brainwashed into thinking that it's worth it to sell 3,000 knickknacks or cookie dough boxes in exchange for a $2 carnival treat.
Oh, that sounds like fun. We'll make sure and catch that. Then Wednesday night, what happens on Wednesdays?
I hope that I can remember my full lineup on Wednesday. I think we're going to listen to Bob McCarty talk about his book, 3 Days in August.
Oh.
Cindy McGee will be talking about Alec, and I can't remember what my third item is. Can you remember, Dave?
I can't remember. I've got it.
I have my notes.
It's Sandy Garber.
Sandy Garber from K&N Patriots.
Yep.
That's right. Thank you.
Okay. And then on Friday next week is the roundtable again. I think our plan for next week, it was our plan for this week, and something came up family for Mike Smith. So it now will be our tentative plan for next week to do a show on fair tax. So all you folks want to tune into that, we'll be talking about the fair tax, what it is, how we get it, why we get it, why we want it, why we need it, and how it works, how it is fair. And how it is, in fact, a progressive tax. Lisa kind of touched on that with her guest last week, and we're going to actually get a little bit more in depth into that and actually discuss the pros and cons. I don't think we have any cons here on this panel, do we?
I think that a fair tax is probably one of the better ideas that have come down the pike in a long time.
Okay, and then I think probably over there in your neck of the woods, Lisa, you have some big events coming up.
Okay, yeah. Ran into the Americans for Prosperity people today at an event I was at. In St. Charles County, there's an emergency meeting of Hands Off My Healthcare on Monday night, July 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Middendorf Credo Library, Meeting Room A on Highway K. Feel free to come there, bring a friend. The legal battle is over, but the political battle is just now forming. They're going to take a microscope to the SCOTUS ruling, and AFP activists will be organizing a local action plan in an effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. That's Monday evening, July 2nd at 7 p.m. And on July 21st, Americans for Prosperity is hosting the Defending the American Dream Summit in Springfield, Missouri, at the Springfield Expo Center. So it's an all-day event starting at 8 p.m. with exhibitors and booths and breakout sessions, and their keynote speaker will be Barry Goldwater Jr., and they'll also have Michael Cannon from Cato there speaking on the Obamacare decision. And you can get in touch with them and register at 314-780-7687 or MissouriDadSummit.eventbrite.com. And all
okay.
of that information is up at Missouri Grassroots Coalition on the events calendar, so you can get all of that information there.
That's MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, folks, .org, the website for Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a unfunded co-op of like-minded patriots throughout the state of Missouri. If your group isn't part of Missouri Grassroots Coalition, you are missing out on a lot of information and support. Vaughn, you had a frustrating day today, didn't you?
Oh, a little bit. It was one of those days where I looked to my client and I told him, I understand. You know, I do domestic disharmony cases sometimes. That's what I call them. They all fall under the same category. And I'll tell you what, I'm glad in this case that both sides were represented by attorneys, even though it was so frustrating and we took so long to get past 98% done to 99% done, to roll it back to 84% done and get back to 98. It was a crazy day. But I remember sitting in court not too many months ago, and there were a wave of those pro se divorces. You know those?
Well, tell the audience what pro se means. They might not all know.
Pro se, I guess the Latin is for yourself, for oneself.
Right.
It's a do-it-yourself divorce. And I guess the Supreme Court, with an advisory committee of attorneys who live in big cities for the most part, decided that the average citizen could do his or her own divorce, whether or not they had children, whether or not they had property, whether or not they had debt. So what they did was create what they call a form and a test. Essentially, if you logged on to the court's website and you completed this questionnaire and printed out the certification that you'd done it, you could then tackle the, I think, 65-page document that was, once you finished checking boxes and filling in information and deciding which pages you were supposed to complete and which pages you weren't, you'd be allowed to file with the court along with your certificate that you took the little test. And what's happening is this thing comes off like a tax code. And people are checking boxes because they're not sure if they should or not. People are filling in things that they're not sure if they should or not, instead of being able to look at it and decide that this is what they need to do. I need to skip pages 32 through 45 because I don't need those. They're filling out everything and filing it with the court as one great big giant document. And what happens is, and in the cases I saw, every single person who'd done that got tossed out of the courtroom by the judge and told to go find a lawyer because they didn't know what they were doing. And lawyers will take these cases, and some of them will just double their fees because now you have to undo what these people have done and redo it the proper way. You know, petition for divorce is what, 3-5 pages, maybe. And so I was sitting there in court today with, you know, impossible people trying to get the possible done and thinking about all of those other folks who didn't have the benefit of having someone there who was trained to put the kibosh on some of the nonsense or who could even guide them through it, and wondering if this is going to be the future of Missouri as the economy tightens and the money runs out and no one is able to hire an attorney. I know a lot of people out there aren't weeping because folks don't want to hire lawyers, but still, you're not going to get your stuff done if you don't get a little bit of guidance, and the self-guidance thing to me is not working.
Well, I'm back to, you know, just to play the devil's advocate on what you're saying there. Why is the thing so complicated that myself and my discordant partner can't go down there and tell the judge what's going on and what we want to do and that be the end of it? I mean, why do we need an attorney? Why is it all that damn complicated is my question.
It's complicated because there is a veritable checklist of things that you have to swear to in order to get a divorce. I got dressed up one side of my head and down the other by an 80-something-year-old woman when I asked her if she was pregnant. And I'm required to do that in order to get her a divorce because the law says we got to put it on hold if you are until we determine who the father is.
That's my argument. Why does the law say that? I mean, why does the law say that my wife and I can't just decide we don't want to be together anymore? What does her being pregnant or not have to do with whether we're together anymore? What does me having terminal cancer have to do with us being together anymore?
Well, in the case of pregnancy, you don't want to bastardize a child if the husband is not the father. And actually, in my circuit, more and more often, you're going to find people who are getting divorced with a spouse who is pregnant with some other person's child, and even more frequently than that, I've noticed people who are getting divorced with husbands who thought they were fathers until wife suddenly says, oh, that was never your child.
But why is the court getting involved in that? The court should get involved in the dissolution, and if the father isn't responsible for maintenance for that child, then so be it. It's not the court's business.
The paternity of that child, if it comes to that being an argument, is a totally different case than we don't want to be together anymore.
Yes, argument.
Yes and no. I represented a gentleman who'd raised a child for 8 years believing it was his daughter, and he wanted very much to remain a part of that child's life even as he was divorcing his wife, and it totally shocked him when she filed her answer and counterpetition alleging that he was not the biological father. And, of course, what happened is that now I think the court ordered me to go find the biological father or find a putative father and bring that person in to keep from bastardizing a child because that's the term of welfare. Well, what happened is found a father, disenfranchised the husband, broke his heart, destroyed his life, because
the court overstepped its boundaries again. It wasn't your job to go find the father. That wasn't your job.
I think there's a statute that says if we're going to say that this person is not the father, we have to name if we know someone who might actually be and bring that person into the case.
See, and that's my point. These are laws written by a crapload of lawyers to protect the legal system. I mean, to protect the legal system against somebody like Lisa and I going to a judge and saying we don't want to be married anymore.
You know, I'm all in favor of having a license that expires and has to be renewed every few years.
I'm all in, you know me, I'm a libertarian. I'm all in favor of why does the government have anything to say to start with who I'm married to and why?
Well, they say they're trying to protect the children. Now, if you have no property, no debt, you can basically go in there and find a way to get it done. But when there are children involved, it becomes a great big old mess. And usually the people who get tossed out are people who have children because of all the legal requirements that have to be met. And this post-divorce thing, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it does not work for people with children. It barely works for people with debt. And it really, truthfully, doesn't work that well for people who have neither debt nor children nor property because they still have to figure out how to file that, how to complete it, and how to get it in front of a judge without getting tossed out.
Go ahead, Lisa. No sense sitting over there fighting, Lisa.
What a hot button. I think the court has gotten too – well, you know, I'll be honest with you, and you may not like it, and I'm not trying to offend, but the court – I think the court on every level has done more to disassemble the family unit and the culture of the family in this country by sticking its nose in places it does not belong.
And I'll
more than any other institution.
I would disagree and say it's the Department of Social Services.
Well, I would say that I think that they're married. I think that I've seen some horrific things in the family courts, and the Department of Social Services certainly does muddy up the water, and none of it ever comes out in the best interest of the children. And I have never seen, in my experience, which is probably not as vast as yours, but I've never seen anybody in the courts or the social services really looking out for the interest of the kids. It's usually it's a CYA move on somebody's part, either in the courts or the social services or the guardian ad litem issue. It's never about the kids. Never.
Well, I'll go you one further and throw legal aid into the mix. I used to be a legal aid lawyer, and I'll tell you my opinion is that they've done every bit as much harm as good. I remember it was very popular for people to call legal aid and have them open a file so they could discuss their case even if they were not eligible for services, because once they did that, they could go to court with their attorney, their paid attorney, their private attorney, and file something, and then the respondent could not get a legal aid lawyer in this area
conflicted out
of the conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a very popular move. I remember legal aid had a policy of deciding whether to accept or reject people's applications based on the telephone interview. No verification whatsoever of income, just whatever they were told. I did a case years and years ago with legal aid where my client and opposing party between them had something like 8 to 10 rental properties and a business. And she still got legal aid assistance. To me,
I believe legal aid in my county now to avoid what you've, and I think that was a common practice, but to avoid what you're doing, what you're talking about, I believe legal aid in my, I know because my daughter-in-law works at legal aid, has one attorney on staff. Everything else they do is farmed out to private attorneys. And
yes,
that way they get to avoid the conflict issues because they can have two clients at the same time. I mean, two spouses going against each other who are both represented by lawyers who are paid by legal aid.
That's always been the case in my experience. Legal aid has always had one or two or maybe even three attorneys on staff in the offices I've worked with and farmed out the vast majority of their cases to local attorneys.
Simply
because...
How can you call How can you call a conflict then when Joe Jones from the Joe Jones Law Office is defending Mrs. Smith and Frank Reynolds from the Frank Reynolds Law Office is defending Mr. Smith?
Because Mary Married is calling legal aid and completing her application and giving her information to the legal aid office.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And it is legal aid who reads the case, determines the issues, determines whether or not they're going to accept the case, and then goes out and finds an attorney in the community who will take it. And I have had attorney after attorney say this to me. They will not take legal aid cases because there's a lot to be said for the old truth that if you're getting something for free, it has every bit the value.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Nothing's free. I'm on Lisa's side in this one. I think that that judges work to keep attorneys in business to a great degree, I would resent it. If Lisa and I didn't want to get along anymore and we wanted to go get a divorce, I see no reason why we couldn't just go to a judge and say, here's what happened. We want to get a divorce, and I do or don't want to pay her $600 a month, and she does or doesn't want me to pay her $1,200 a month, and tell us what we need to do.
And that can happen as long as you don't have any kids. And in some cases, you know, courts will grant a divorce and reserve the issue of custody for later because that's the one everyone really fights over. But, you know, if there are children involved, you can't escape the court interference unless the children aren't from you.
And my experience is runs right along with Lisa's as far as this guardian ad litem thing goes. In 50% of the cases I know where couples divorce with children, the couples themselves care primarily about what's good for their children. In about 50% of the cases I know. In the other 50% know the children just become an arguing chip. And at that point, I have not seen a case where the court, in anything but words, put the good of those children ahead of everything else.
At guardian ad litem, at least in my county, it is used to escalate the case.
To make money.
Yeah, and everybody wins except the kids. And I tell you, I've seen them put kids through absolute. I've seen them do some terrible things to kids. Put kids in harm's way. Put them with the wrong parent, where kids are being abused. I've seen some horrible things in that system. It's just terrible. And the judges know what's going on, and they're just letting it happen.
Well, I think I'm going to have to say, having been appointed as guardian ad litem in quite a few cases in my time, not nearly as many as some of my colleagues, enough. I think you're talking about city GALs. Those guys actually get paid because, in many cases, they can put a lien against the county for their fees. Down here in the country, you get paid, it's a miracle.
Please don't get offended. I'm not making a general slam against attorneys. I think you're probably a very conscientious guardian ad litem, but it's the system. It's the system that I think is bad for Lisa and I, who just decided we don't want to be married anymore, and we went down to the courthouse and we ran into this system that makes it heartache for us to do something that we could have just sat down at the kitchen table and said, we just don't want to do this anymore.
I think it would be easy to do that if the kids weren't involved. And I think that you're never going to find a way to keep the courts out of it now that the legislature has essentially laid out the groundwork. To be truthful, it begins and ends with the legislature and what they say we are supposed to do with regard to children.
I agree, and that's what I said. It's the system. It's not involved.
Involved.
I have no idea what either of you just said.
Oh.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Go ahead. They're too involved. There's just too much. There's too much government involvement in that process from beginning to end. Kids and everything, unless there is neglect and abuse, and I have seen attorneys and guardians ad litem generate evidence so that they can be in cases of neglect and abuse that wasn't there,
But unless there's neglect and abuse, the courts have no business in this at all, as far as I'm concerned. And the legislature that promulgated that by generating bills and laws to allow that to happen they've done nothing but perpetuate the problem.
Let's move away from the kids for a minute. I have living in my house an 87-year-old woman who has Alzheimer's disease. My father-in-law died, and all we needed to do was sell her house so we could move her in with us. Now we went to see an attorney, and she was too far gone, I guess, to sign a power of attorney. And so this attorney convinced us that the only way we could sell the house was to do a conservatorship. All we needed to do was sell the house, put the money in her bank account where it would sit until she either needed it or left it. That's all we needed to do. So we were pushed into this conservatorship. Now we're in a conservatorship where a judge has to look at every penny we spend, and I had an attorney on the phone this week say, "What is this check for $27?" And the attorney was told, "Well, we were in a store and she saw a pair of shoes she wanted." And the attorney said, "Well, you have to call me before you do that next time so that I can get the okay of the judge to buy a damn pair of shoes." I've got a woman living. Now, this is a woman who's lived her whole life where she could just go down. I mean, she's got a little over $100,000 in the bank. She lived her whole life where she could just go down to the store. If she saw a dress she wanted, she could buy it. If she wanted a car, she could buy it. Now, we're not going to let her have a car, of course. But what I'm saying is this woman now lives on a court-ordered budget so strict that she has to count the number of bags of M&Ms she buys in a month. Or we have to count them for her.
Well, no, hey, if you're in a nursing home and you're on Medicaid, you're down to $35 a month spending money, too.
She's not. In a nursing home. She's not on Medicaid. She has
conservatorship. There's all this interference. There are all these rules that tell you what you can do, what you can spend, and how you can live your life.
It's incredible. This woman is living in poverty with $100,000 in the bank.
See, that's my husband's area. He's the elder care guru in our office, and I get appalled when I hear these things, and I'd be looking for
that's,
change. That's
the system that I'm complaining about. I mean, I wasn't complaining about my specific case. I'm complaining about this is the system. As it turns out, we find out 2 years later when you can't get out of a conservatorship once you're in it that we didn't need one to start with.
Probably not. And, once you get trapped in the system, it is really, really, really hard to –
Oh, you can't get out of it. Yeah, it is. That's
possible.
Very true. Once
it's
you're in
possible.
It, you can't get out of it.
It's possible. It's just not always likely, for one. People don't know that they can. And two, if they know they can, they don't know how. And, quite frankly, some people don't trust attorneys to do it for them. You get burned once, you don't want to go there again.
Six minutes. Wrap something up, Vaughn.
Okay. Here's my take on Obamacare. I think that it is a blow, but not a fatal one. I think that if we just step back and look at our other avenues, which are the ones we should have gone to in the first place, the Supreme Court has never been a reliable arbiter of fair and not fair. The Supreme Court has always been an esoteric group of eggheads whose job it is to parse little details down to the nubbins and make it difficult for the average man to understand what's going on. I think that the fight now goes back to where it should have gone, which is the legislature and the state. And I think with those heavy hitters in the game, we can overturn Obamacare and get back to common sense and let all of this other stuff go. I have faith. I'm an optimist.
There you go, Lisa. Lisa, you get the last word tonight. I think Vaughn got the last word last week, so you get the last word tonight. I'm a libertarian. Everybody knows it. I do not want the government involved in my divorce. I do not want the government involved in my marriage. I don't want a license to marry. I don't want a license to drive a damn car. I don't want my doctor to have to be licensed. I don't want my dentist to have to be licensed. I believe that if a guy can learn to do surgery on his kitchen table from his daddy, who's been a fourth generation doctor, and I feel safe going to have him take out my appendix on his kitchen table, then that, you know, consumer beware. I don't want the government telling me that I can or can't buy eggs or milk from the farm down the street. So I'm on Lisa's side in this one. There's too much system, and get it out of my life. Lisa, you got the last word tonight.
Well, hard to disagree with that. I like Vaughn's optimistic attitude. I really wish that I could be that optimistic. You know, I'll tell you, I was really knocked off center yesterday by what happened. I am really afraid. I think it has just far reaching consequences that people aren't even thinking about yet. I think that the Constitution was bastardized in such a way, and I know Vaughn explained it very well, that, you know, to the contrary, but I think that it was just hit so hard, and the precedent that I'm afraid that it might set is just frightening to our foundational freedoms. You know, and it just strayed so far astray from what the founders had envisioned for us when they laid all the Constitution out in the first place. What I want to see happen, I want to see people get angry. I want a landslide at the polls in November. I don't want to just barely beat Barack Obama by 6 or 7 points. I want it to be a landslide. And then I want a major bloodletting in D.C. and in Jefferson City. I want to see the people hold the elected's feet to the fire. You know, if we're going to put them in there to fix this darn mess that has promulgated itself for so many years, and they get back in there and their spines turn to mush, I want to see a bloodletting like you've never seen. I want impeachments. I want people being ousted, you know, in the next election. I want it to be a bloody mess. I want the people to uprise and start holding people accountable like we never have, because, I mean, we really have no one else to blame but ourselves. We put ourselves in this mess because we have been complacent for far too long and far too forgiving, and our elected have become our friends. And we've placed them on pedestals, and we treat our elected like rock stars, and we've allowed them to do this to us. And it's really our own fault, but now they've gone too far, and I want to see people get angry about it.
The kingdom of America, huh? I forecast gas under $3 by the end of August. I forecast a war in Iran by October, and I forecast it doesn't help. I forecast a landslide for Mitt Romney. Vaughn's here tonight. See Vaughn again on Tuesdays. Show me common sense. Lisa's been here tonight. Thank you, Lisa. See Lisa on Wednesday night, the Culture Vigilante. I'm Dave. This is Missouri Grassroots Radio. It's been a great roundtable. Thanks, ladies. I've really enjoyed it.
You're welcome.
Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you listeners all next week. Everybody have a great weekend. This is Dave. It's Missouri Grassroots Radio, and it's a wrap.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.